Welcome to North Beats from North Beach. I'm your host, Corey Luna, chatting with the people behind electronic music. Today we chat with Carolyn Falk, a.k.a. Sirnai. Sirnai has been creating music since the early 80s in industrial electronic music. And she came by today and chatted with me for 2 hours. And we go from talking about her music into being a mother, raising her child, and into the spectrum of frequency of the body. And a couple announcements. We've got Peaked. That's again Peaked, P-I-Q-U-E-D. You can find out more at PeakedSF on Instagram. And you can find us on meetup.com as well. Look up Peaked. And that is my friend Rich Hogben and I. We've put together a show where we showcase two musicians at a time. And that runs from 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. Go and check out Resonant Frequencies the first Sunday of every month. And check out Resident in San Francisco. Third Tuesday of every month here in the Mission District. Back in March, I put my first solo album out under the name Kizzl, K-Z-Z-L. And the album is called Lixiviate. And if you like the album, I've got digital albums for sale, and I also have a cassette tape as well. And now, let's get into Sirnai. Thank you very much for doing my podcast, North Beats from North Beach.
Sure. Sounds great.
First off, tell me a little bit about how you got into playing music.
Well, legend has it that this goes really back to when I was very distinctfully when I was nine. I was in New Jersey, and I had piano lessons, but for some reason, you know, I ended up hiding from the teacher. And so there was an evening one night where I heard some, in the middle of the night, I kind of heard this voodoo drum. We had a four-story house, a three-story plus an attic. And I just heard this voodoo thing in the living room, and I was like, what's that? And I went down there, and it was like my father building a drum machine. It was the Paya drummer boy. And so for some reason that traveled with me somewhere, you know, after having moved so many times, I don't know how I still have it.
You still have it today?
I still have the drum machine, yeah. Wow. And in fact, my first album when I was, you know, I was starting to do electronic music, after a whole rock phase in the 70s, but we're early 80s, like maybe 80, 81, mm-hmm. It just switched. And I started, just to mention, my father was an audiophile, and so he would just collect all these just different instruments, and definitely just like the best, you know, quadraphonic speakers. And he would build for just a hobby. He was computer systems analyst, and he worked for banks and stuff. So as a hobby, he would build analog gear. So it was drum machines, analog delays, flanger. A lot of it was Paya. There was another synthesizer by Paya as well. So I think he just did all of those. And he had a four-track, a TIAC four-track. And then, you know, no one could touch his stuff, but I could look. Anyway, so I didn't live in New Jersey very long, and we just ended up back in the West Coast. Probably during that time period, I also start writing into diaries. I just realized how day-to-day changed because, you know, I took notes of the weather and the degrees and things like that because I hadn't seen snow before until then. So when I went to California, I just continued journaling. So kind of coinciding with journaling and my music, everything just was logged in by date and time from the beginning. So it would always be, that's just my, I haven't really named my work until recently. I mean, my, all my files and cassette, all the songs on the cassette, and I just had to just name them by the date and time. So, anyway, the, probably, and I was, doing a lot of drawing, and so my, fundamentally, I'm more visual, but I've always been into writing stories. So somehow when I was, you know, when it came to the 80s and 81, I sort of, I was kind of writing music in a vacuum because there's no females, definitely no females who was doing what I was doing, like the multi-tracking and plugging in the different effects. And I didn't know about the four tracks until, well, I tried to do overdubbing by recording tape recorders to tape recorders. And then I just kept duplicating it. And then finally I'm wondering, how can I do more, get more tracks? So, but somehow I discovered my father's four track in the living room and all his leftover instruments from like, garage sales or whatever. So the, it would range from, you know, flute, saxophone, clarinets. We had a piano, a Rhodes keyboard, a drum set. We had...
It's a great childhood.
Excuse me?
Sounds like a great childhood.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just, it was there, but it wasn't, that's not what I was driven to do. It was more of a kind of a hobby too. So just like it was a hobby for him, I guess. But for me, it was always drawing, and that was my main interest. But since it was there, you know, all this gear and chords and everything, I had, I think when I was, by the time I was 16, I might have had about 12 different guitars and basses and mandolins. I had like all the different kinds of string instruments, violin. I had it just about almost, because I had just and bongo drums too. And I would travel, you know, in my teens, or actually a little bit after my teens, but I would collect instruments from around the world as well. I think I went to Thailand and got something from there. I went to Egypt and got some hand drums from there. And just wherever I went, in China too, Chinese guitar. So everywhere I went, I had to like get an instrument from that country. So I would, it would just be add to that whole collection. So around the, you know, 80, 81, everything, the type of music, it just changed. I think I just got, you know, as a teenager, I started getting into to punk bands, and I was in a couple of those. And I did a cover of The Cure when, you know, one of their first albums came out as well, back then. That, I guess, well, jumping to current day, I have a new box set that Dark Entries put out, and it actually contains the cover of The Cure that I did in 80-81. Nice. In a 7-inch. So that's includes, it's included in the box set. So just wanted to tie that in because I was talking about the early 80s. But so then I got really into Cabaret Voltaire. That was,
I love Cabaret Voltaire.
That was a big obsession of mine, like for some years. And I think so many bands today are kind of like offshoots from it. But, and I loved all their stages, however, you know, from the 80s to the 90s. However pop they tried to become, but it was still experimental in their own way. Mm-hmm. And Europe's a lot more accepting of electronics and art, and yeah, for so many years ahead. So oh, it wasn't until only some years, a couple of years ago, I guess, where electronic music was just started to flourish in the U.S. And I mean, I remember, you know, in the 90s, this is kind of an odd one to talk about, but like I had a cousin who introduced me to someone like Nile Rodgers, you know, and he was trying to connect me to people, but he was just telling me to go to Europe. And cause at the time, you know, everything was grunge. And, we met up a little later as well and had some drinks in, Sacramento. And it's interesting cause he introduced me as a singer. So it was like, I didn't want to say anything. But anyway, so those are the kind of like little, I mean, I've just been everywhere trying to promote electronic music for forever. And I've always been in this vacuum where whatever phase I'm in, I'm always in the vacuum of my own. Even today, what I'm doing, I just have this perspective. And I don't know, maybe I've been, it's been self-reinforcing as well. I mean, when I was 16, I was doing it in, you know, kind of this vacuum and just kind of develop my own style. I mean, back then, no one said it was anything was experimental. That I didn't know that term. But and it was interesting because some of the reviews I had for my first album, Chart Blossoms, you know, people were amazed how much I could fit into four tracks, and the only way to do that, I didn't know about mixing. It wasn't even through a mixing board. I used a reverb mic to angle the sounds I was recording to get the EQ. So I was just, wow. You know, that's how I thought I could vary the sound. And then I, of course, experimenting with plugging, you know, daisy chaining different effects, analog to delay or whatever, and through an amp. And so, you know, just kind of inventing like different techniques. It was, again, just kind of for fun, yeah. But then it ended up being an album. And then probably some years after that, it became kind of like cassette based for a little bit, still in the 80s, because there wasn't enough room on vinyl. So they ended up becoming, you know, these 90 minute tapes or whatever, you know, 80, 60, 90 minute tapes. And, you know, I've been through the whole period of like the analog through the digital realms. And I think ever since the digital kicked in, you know, for me in the late 80s, you know, I don't think I went back really. So anyway, I'm rambling. You asked one question. That's what you get.
And I'm very happy that you're reflecting on so much. It's fantastic to hear.
Yeah, one question is an hour.
That's great.
So if you have 10 questions, all right.
No, that's great. I'm so fascinated by, you know, the process that you're describing of, you know, in the 80s. This is how you were able to do so much work onto a four track recorder. You know, the reverb and daisy chaining. It's fantastic to hear because, you know, I wasn't, you know, that's not my background. So I don't know about that exactly.
And it's interesting, this whole modular thing too, because I mean, stemming from, you know, the early, you know, a couple decades earlier, maybe. I don't know when it's exactly started or where, but I tried modular, I think once or twice, yeah. To be honest. I had like an SMS little small version of it, like this bigger wall SMS, I think. I don't think you can really find it these days, but yeah, it was just one thing that came and went. But I love, of course, you know, the sounds and its rawness and everything. But to be honest, what I ended up doing was just sampling all my changes. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, that's luckily today, you know, there's a lot of hybrid, you know, there's a lot of digital hybriding into the modular, and which is, you know, something I can explore perhaps. But I guess back then I always needed to date and time everything. I guess, like, you know, I had to document everything. So I couldn't document those knobs. I couldn't do it. And right. Same with mixing boards. You know, it wasn't until I encountered something like the Euphonics, and this was like maybe 94, 95, a friend of mine he worked at this recording studio, and he gave me the keys to it for a couple days to mix down Transfiguration. And you know, I just brought my alarm clock so I can, you know, sleep in the ISO booth because I had all that time, you know, so. But that was one of the first mixing boards that you can do recall, like digital recall. Okay. Now I have this Yamaha one, and it's it's amazing how the price changed, you know, changed since then.
Sure.
But, you know, back then it was really the cutting edge mixing board that I knew of. And you can recall all your settings, your EQ or whatever, and automate. It was one of the few ones. I think, you know, I don't even know if Pro Tools, I think Pro Tools was just starting. And I had like just a DigiDesign with Vision, Studio Vision and Sample Cell, you know, without...
The early
90s? Yeah, the early 90s. That's how I was kind of emerging into the digital. But I always liked being able to recall stuff. If I can't recall stuff, I don't want to put the effort because it's like I'll lose it. But that's just me because I've learned throughout the years, you know, through moving and different environments and different, you know, gaining, losing friends or whatever, that time just, you know, it's just this, it's like a, it's an ongoing, how should I call this? Like, it's a radio station that's always on, and it's going to be filled with something.
Yeah.
And I just learned early that, you know, when things change over, you kind of don't kind of get it back. I mean, you can want to go back and you try to envision stuff, but that's just how time works. So I don't know. I invest my time certain way, I guess. But what's happened was just like I never sought my things to be anything in particular in terms of like, you know, I didn't have a goal of making, I'm going to make 100 albums or anything like that. It's just like it's all the experiments happened. A lot of them happened in the 80s. It did happen in the analog world. But then again, no one has seen my save as in my digital settings. So like, you know, analog wise, I have so many cassettes, you just keep recording. But then when you get into the save as and in the digital realm, I mean, no one has seen how many I have on those. So there's probably a lot more than 100.
So you probably have saved everything you've ever played.
If I have something that I've experimented with or whatever, I save it. And then, you know, I've once said that that I do remixes until I get the original. So I would just keep doing the remix, and then maybe the original will come out of it. So it's like the different way of coming at your hit song.
Are you using a particular program for recording nowadays?
That's a great question because it's funny because I just wasn't completely expecting to have been included in the great MuTeC festival, the digital festival, and I was using Pro Tools. I mean, I'm a Pro Tools digital design person since it was invented, and in fact, in the 90s, I invented a digital editor, like a batch editor, because at that time you had to edit all your waveforms, so every single sample, because everything was all samples. I mean, that was the hype back then. So I didn't want to edit every single thing. So I had programmed something called a robotic editor. And so you can go through like 500 drum sample hits and then just press go and it'll edit all within a minute. Mm-hmm. So you have all of it and then you load it into your sample or whatever. And that worked great. So I've always been a Pro Tools person. Now, when MuTeC came along, or even slightly before, because I knew I wanted to do some live anyway, but I found myself having to, I mean, I've been procrastinating for years to try to deprogram myself from Pro Tools. You know, it's a cult, a Pro Tools cult into another cult, the Ableton cult. And so I had a friend, this guy named Raven. He was, I just found him from some blog or something, but you know, he was really great at helping to, help me understand how it worked. And it's so different from Pro Tools. I mean, after seeing the differences and I mean, everything has plus and minus. I mean, Pro Tools, to be honest, sounds better, but I mean, maybe I didn't find the right setting in Ableton or whatever. Maybe I had to put in the tones or, you know, some other setting, but I can hear the difference. I mean, I can hear the difference between that tape manufacturers. I mean, the Maxell to Sony. I know the difference. I mean, I don't know. It's all digital, but I can still hear it. Anyway, so I can hear it with Ableton. But the thing that Ableton's amazing. It's the time stretch factor and being able to, you know, there's a new product called the Sensal Morph that is. Absolutely. When I first saw that only some weeks ago, I was like, I had to have this. And it was just, it's basically, it looks like a trackpad, like a big trackpad, yeah. But you can overlay, they have overlays and you can make it a drum pad or a you can control different things. You can do, actually there's a blank pad. You can assign where you could design, you could draw a cartoon and then make something trigger from somebody's head or whatever. I mean, it's a really amazing new technology that
is
I,
that yeah. Is that a different design from Max MSP?
I don't know how it's created.
The environment of it.
I'm not as familiar with Max, to be honest, but I don't know how it was created, but I think they do take advantage of the MIDI polyphonic expression with what's that program? The Bitwig?
I don't know Bitwig.
I'm starting to forget that. I keep forgetting that name. But it's really amazing the potential it has. It's basically sensor technology. Wow. So, and I started thinking of all kinds of things you could, in the future, what you could do with sensor technology. And in one of my talks at MuTech, the future of musical instruments, I just went to town on that subject of the future and sensor technology, what you could do, because you can merge. I'm hoping, you know, other sciences can merge with, you know, different types, you know, with music or art, you know, because I think everything's becoming like a polymath of things where, you know, we're always trying to represent what we are, you know, as human beings. And so, you know, I also have been, you know, over the years studying certain types of meditation practices that where you can, you know, I've been studying with swamis and I've been understanding human to human frequency exchange. So it's a very tactile thing. You can feel energy when you walk out of a room, when you sit with like a monk or whatever. It's really real. Wow. And I would envision, you know, using some kind of sensor, like in something called a QEEG, they use for, to do brain mapping. Oh, wow. For like right now it's for people who have maybe some impairments like autism and, people, you know, they want to be able to pinpoint where it is in their brain. So they can, when they sense it, it prints out a map of the regions that they might have a deficit. So if there's a speech deficit or whatever, it'll show up, and then they would maybe program something around it using neurofeedback. So something like that, like and I'll look into it. Mm-hmm. So somehow, if there's a way to, you know, use some kind of sensor technology and take a snapshot of the energy that I've been studying, for example, my hopes is that there's a way to, and I'm sure there's some studies now, perhaps, where, you know, I could eventually take a snapshot of the state that I'm in, the energy, and then save it as a plugin, date and time. And then I could go back to, you know, I want, you know, 2003 layered with a 2019 mood I was in, and, you know, to create the layers of, you know, colors, you know, you can color code, and to be able to transcend time, because eventually, you know, someone will have a snapshot of what, you know, a certain musician you know, what their frequencies were. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential in the technology today. And that's why I think, I mean, the hybrid of the analog and the digital, you know, it had to happen.
I think you're onto something with that a lot. Because, so I went to Synthplex in March.
Oh, I went there.
Oh, you were there.
I was there.
Oh. We must have crossed paths.
Yeah, that's where I discovered Sensilmore.
Maybe that's where if I looked familiar, maybe that's where you saw me.
Yeah, you look familiar.
Okay, maybe it was there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was a photographer for the event, so I was running around every day.
Oh, I was
everywhere.
That was you.
It was me. Yes. I got in front of every panel I could get into. I sat in the very front so that I could get the best photos. Wow. Even though, like, there's, like, they had video cameras going on 24/7 in the back for every, you know, speaker, which I think was great. Like, they had excellent coverage of everything. But I've just, you know, over the years of, I think I've got, I don't know, maybe 20 years of photography behind me, and I've done it so often that I'm not shy or embarrassed to put myself in front of everybody to get the right shot.
You have way more terabytes than I do. I can tell you that.
But one of my favorite panels that I sat in for was Alan Howarth.
I was there.
For his,
that was amazing.
Where he talked about the frequency of the mind and through the body. You were there. You were in that room.
Yeah, I was.
That was my favorite talk.
I think so. What was that number?
He said it was between 425 and 440.
Right. Okay. And so that was the one that if you tune everything to.
Yeah.
Right, right. It was so funny because he had all kinds of calculations going.
He really did.
He had everything down to the number.
I'm still fascinated by it.
Yeah.
I really am.
I know. I was surprised how mathematical that was, that
Me
panel.
Too. I was so impressed that he went to Egypt and rented a pyramid to measure the king's room.
I know.
And it was fascinating.
That's so funny. I know. He went all the way there to rent the room to get the frequency. So that's what I'm talking about. See, yeah. I'm in the neuro, the realm, that area. I mean, I like to go into the brain area, the chamber, the king's chamber in my head. Yeah, that's where I want to go.
And do you think that some, you know, over the, you know, with, in the same light as what you're talking about of, like, kind of creating, you know, a frequency portrait of where an artist's mind is, you know, throughout their lifetime. Do you think that maybe some of your music are portraits at that time of where your mind is?
Absolutely. It's as I was saying, I was writing in diaries, and I have at least 50 diaries, at least, because then it went into computers, so it's more. But I already have something ready to print, actually. It's been edited already and everything. They're all portraits of that time period. I mean, not that time, but throughout the time. And I think it, from journaling, you know, writing diaries to drawing to all the different mediums that I just felt that were natural outlets, like his music, and even within the outlet, like music, there'd be all the other things, like the instrument, each kind of instrument too. It's not like just one keyboard my whole life. it's like the salad bar, you know, you have everything. But it's just, yeah, they're portraits, but they're, I call it like a movie that's been running for 30-40 years. It's never stopped. Mm-hmm. It's always been going. It's nobody stopped the camera, and nobody stopped me either.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, my parents didn't really say I couldn't or couldn't do anything. I mean, it was just, they knew I was an artist. But I think I just had this sense of freedom, and nobody really said you couldn't do it.
Good.
I don't know. So, because there's hindrances people have, and that a lot of things that people have to really, jump hoops to try to get creative or whatever, but it's I don't think that's been the, if I'm too conscious of it, maybe, but for so many years I think partly I just didn't you know, when you feel like nobody's watching, you know, you just do whatever you want. Like, yes. I didn't really have to create a hit, and, you know, I didn't have to really do anything. So, and that's why I have so much work. I mean, it was really only until maybe a year or two ago, I decided to try to collect all my cassettes or my reels and all the DAT tapes and digital files everywhere. And I just realized I had about like over 100 albums of stuff. Wow. Plus field recordings. I carried my recorders everywhere from the, you know, Sony Walkman period, you know, cassette in Europe, in around the world, actually Thailand and, China, even on a camel and in Egypt. Recording this guy that was supposed to be my tour guide, and he was singing on the camel and stuff. But it was I love memories. I mean, I'm just yeah. So I feel like I liked going back and looking at stuff, and also it's actually very therapeutic too, because, you know, if you hit a snag in your psyche about something, it's always about something, and then you can pinpoint it. And there's a lot of therapies out there that do the same thing, but they're, you know, they're therapies. But if you can do your own, you know, you don't need a psychiatrist or something. That's but true. I don't know. I mean, well, I've done so many things to try to, I mean, not just therapeutic, but just to move your synapses forward, you know, also to develop it, you know, to develop your brain as well. So anyway, so if I were to, you know, hit a snag in the psyche, I can go back to like a diary I had in the 80s and read through it like an old friend who would tell me all the things that happened. I would say, oh, that's, you know, that's where it was. Oh, I get it. I understand. I can move forward. But I went back to move forward. And I kind of did that a few times. It's soothing, like it's really soothing for me. And so, but moving forward wise too, developmentally, I researched, or not researched. I studied under several swamis for like the last 20 years, and really focusing on like the idea of the energy exchange idea and the frequency. And it's so, I've never experienced anything like that. That's so real. That's so tangible and very physical. Cause you know, if you do meditation or something, you kind of don't think, you think it's sort of like Zen, just a state or something, like it's a frame of mind. But when you understand, the practice is Kundalini yoga, and, it's a certain particular type. It's an eye open. It's a transmission. So the Swami would sit there and they would look at you. And then by the end of an hour, you know, you're purified. You see everything really clear. I don't know how they do it, but it's pretty amazing. And I used to travel to different cities different places to, where some of them were, I try to go to, there's certain places in the world too, like physical locations that you can kind of get kind of the same thing. And so I travel to places like Sedona, Arizona, which is a pretty amazing place. So just travel to a certain place. And then I would bring my computer and my laptop and my musical, instruments or, you know, just laptop stuff and try to compose while I'm in that, you know, where the energy is. And then I would, for one of my albums, I really went out and I would compose only after, you know, a Swami empowerment, like because you're such in a empowered state of mind, like you're in such a high frequency that's the time to do it. So I would harness that time and just, you know, I knew what I was planning to do. And I did an album called Magic Realism, and that was a kind of a low-key release, but that was all that's what that was all about.
Did you put some of that on your website?
Yeah, the website that's I've accumulated all the, and you know, archived everything's, sure, It's called memoirofsound.com.
Memoir of Sound?
Memoir of Sound. So it's like a memoir, kind of like that, like a diary or journal, you know, of sound.
Yeah.
So I have everything there from the 80s, 90s, 2000, anything I could find that was recorded. They weren't meant to be, you know, album stuff. So that's why they're kind of like archived. And if there's more versions of one thing, I would say it's just an ABC or whatever. And like, you know, the save as type of thing. Mm. It pretty much has all the bands and everything, pretty much everything I've pretty much done. I think I might have left out just one or two things, because I want to use it for remix or live or something like that. There may be a couple things that aren't on there yet too, and eventually I want to create a little documentary, like at least a video. I don't have many videos out at all, surprisingly. It's just not didn't become a focus of mine, but now I'm really into it. I want to do one, so yeah.
What is your goal with doing a video? You just want to have like a compilation of like, you know, performances, something like that, or
it's just in kind of an introduction, because I think that for as long as I've been around and what I've have accomplished, there's a lot of things that people are much better at than me. I mean, people are really out there promoting and shows and you can be like worldwide known and you have one album, you know, if you know how to do it right.
Yeah,
you know,
you're right.
And I don't know how good what that album would be, but and maybe it's great, you know. It's just an area that every single stage I was in, I just felt like it wasn't good enough either. I mean, I kind of felt it's not a pop album, you know, it's more developmental stuff. So it's always developing. It's kind of like the diary that never has an end to it, you know, and then finally I just had to like just edit all into albums. It's just been processed the whole time. I just feel like I have so much to say about the whole, there's so many aspects, you know, from technologically to life to, you know, so many things that have happened. I have not given many interviews about, so I really appreciate your taking the time to interview.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. So tell me a little bit more about, you know, some of the things that some of the projects you've worked on that have been very important to you.
Well, obviously there's the essential albums, which is on the memoirofsound.com. Again, they're all the different phases, and they can correlate to my diaries. I mean, once they're published and you can read about the section in the 80s, you know, where my music came from, you can understand where, you know, whatever my dilemmas were at the time and where, how I worked it out. And, I think it's really interesting. They're really correlated. I mean, because at the time in the 80s, I was going to college, and then so many experiments came out of that. And I think just music was my social life. I mean, in art school, I don't think I had too many friends in art school. They were all music people out of our art school. Developed out of like different bands. And there are a lot of phases. I've been in a couple collective, situations where, you know, a lot of people, would get together and put their parts into a band or whatever, into a project. And, I think the last group I was in, it was back in, it ended like 91 or something. It was like a really long time ago, but that was with Rhythm and Noise. And that was like an industrial outfit way out in, called The Compound, out in the outskirts of San Francisco. And, it was housed in a, this kind of this warehouse, and they had like a sound traffic control tower in it, housing a synclavier. And I was kind of given a lot of leeway in terms of just composing there. I would go there like 10 at night, and, you know, Not Human would pick me up at 10 at night. And I would,
you know, Not Human?
Everybody knows Not Human. Who doesn't know Not Human now?
Okay.
Do you know Not Human?
I've met him.
Okay.
I haven't seen him since maybe 2003.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think he's kind of nomading around right these days. And he doesn't have a place. He has no certain place now.
Yeah. So, I remember. I think I was at his last studio in 2003.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
oh,
which was off of, I think it was off of Folsom or Bryant.
Okay.
Can't quite remember.
Yeah, I left Rhythm and Noise in 91 or something like that. And so, you know, working with the synclavier was a really big step for in terms of understanding the digital realm and sampling. And it was just like a real high quality instrument, obviously. I think from there, I mean, I did compose rhythms. And for, you know, 12 hours, you know, a couple times a week or something. That was just his realm. And the live thing was like, I think it was such a gigantic outfit because, you know, we had a guy that played Tesla Coil and six drummers. And then, I don't know, they would transport the audience in buses and blindfold them and it's just like all kinds of weird theatrical stuff. And at the time we were trying to get a record album. Yeah. I mean, who's going to sign that, you know, you'd have to carry, you know, how many tons of stuff traveling if you were going to play anywhere else. But, anyway, there's some, you know, of course some obvious, like most bands, there's politics and, you know, weird stuff. So, I know I just left that. And then, that was very transformative, I think, for me. And it was just really interesting. And then I created Transfiguration, which was has an 80-page book, and I've collected like actual dreams I've had. That's something I explored. And I think there's like over 100 dreams. And that's in the book that comes with Transfiguration. Although some people just get like the download, they don't really know there's a whole book that goes with it. Yeah. So that was another phase. But the biggest period that had an effect was probably like, you know, in the 80s. And I think that's why so many people want to sort of pull me out of the woodwork and reinvestigate what this was, because I had so much freedom. I mean, it was art school, but I also had access to this big building that my relatives were managing at the time. And I had access, like right out my door, there was this big acting theater where I used to take my gear and get the reverbs from just the room.
Oh, cool.
And I mean, it's one of those spaces where you can, you know, ride your bike around. I mean, it was really amazing. Wow. But again, that was very isolating because I was like the only tenant. And
space.
There was one point there where I was the only tenant. And I mean, I think there was like a commercial nail salon or something, like a photo studio or whatever. Those were my neighbors. And, or it was very, you know, commercial area. I never really had roommates. So, you know, I was just, again, in this vacuum, no matter what. So I'm always in this vacuum. So like in, you know, at my parents' house, I developed Charred Blossoms in the living room, which I don't know why they didn't just throw everything away because it's all everywhere. But then again, you know, in the late 80s, I had that building near my art school. My art school is across the street. So I could just go there 5 minutes before class.
That's nice.
I know. And so, you know, then there's that. And then, you know, there's certain periods where I kind of didn't know where to really place myself in the music industry. I mean, I was trying to meet people. And, you know, it was probably the pinnacle of that is I ended up staying in like Trent Reznor's house for a week. You know what I mean? Like trying to meet people.
That's cool.
You know, just, I don't know, networking or whatever. I mean, it was just through a friend or whatever, and got to see, you know, that downward spiral process, and,
awesome.
You know, and met all those people, you know.
So was it the Tate's house?
The Tate house, yeah. That was, it was interesting. I mean, wasn't any, you know, I don't know, I wasn't spooked too much, you know, at night. Although it was like during the LA fires, they usually have these LA fires, and like at night you can hear like these big, like pine cones drop on the roof. They sounded like big thumps. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Who knows? But that was, you know, it was all these special instances. And that's why I'm just saying these things, they just don't last. Some things don't last, and they're just at the time. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the cast of characters will show up in your life when you need to learn something, you know, or you need to... I just believe in that kind of magic. I mean, in terms of like life is a magical thing that, I mean, I don't believe in magic, but like, I just right. believe it's magical that, I've encountered certain people and it was just at that time, it was the right time. And same with now, I think exact same thing's happening right now, you know, with the Dark Entries, box set thing, it just came out of the blue. But then what spawned out of that was, you know, this Mutech came up. And right after Mutech, literally, I'm going to be playing two more. I'm offered a mini tour. I'll be playing in New York May 23rd at Holo. I know this place. I don't know exactly where it is. And then I'm being flown to Detroit. A place called the L Club or something, EL Club. Mm-hmm. At May 26th, and I'm lining up with Suzanne Ciani and 10 Speed Guillotine, Todd Sines, and a couple other people. I have to look on the list again, but there's a few people there, and I think that's coinciding with the Movement Festival or something in Detroit. It was just amazing only in the last few months or whatever, that the amount of interest is shown. I mean, I just tell people, you know, you're 30 years late.
Yeah.
Like, what took you guys so long? Because there's so many times I would have wanted this. I mean, if it was a little earlier, then, you know, I could do a lot more with, so luckily it's better late than never. But still, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, so many things have come back, you know, like, again, you know, this modular thing. And I got a quote from Dave Smith recently from Sequential for this panel. And, you know, he was just mentioning about, like, how he thinks things have kind of maybe gone back a little bit. But, you know, I think we're just retracing in a way. We're just kind of retracing because there's too much going on or whatever. But, again... it's something else is going to come out of it that's totally unique. You know, certain things won't go away, like real instruments, not real instrument, everything's real instrument, but, you know, the traditional instruments, everything's not going away. It's just something new, brand new is going to come out, I think. And I'm hoping, well, maybe AI, you know, an aspect of AI, I want to explore a little bit more about that. I mean, there's so many different mediums, like from the visual realm, that's just completely impressive. It's just really beautiful realities you can create from the digital realm, and, you know, animated ones, you know, hopefully, you know. And then there's 3D audio that's kind of been around for a while, actually, that's been trying to get into the industry, and it's had so many attempts, and maybe now with VR and AR, and, you know, the different R's, you know, that, you know, it's more accepting, and it's not just gaming, hopefully, and, you know, we can use it, creatively, and you know, hopefully we can get it, you know, on kind of in the affordable, you know, realm that you know you can, that anyone can kind of daisy chain things if they wanted, just like a little pedal.
Have you experimented with with 3D audio?
Yeah, I've my album The Listener back in 2001. I was introduced to 3D audio by a really interesting pioneer, Chris Carell. He actually worked, he was the synclavier player for Michael Jackson. And he contacted me and, you know, to collaborate or whatever, but I didn't know he had this whole development of 3D audio that, you know, you have to put headphones on, but, or you can do it without, but you have to arrange it a certain way. But you couldn't tell the difference between, like, if you had the headphones on and someone knocked on the door across the room, you think it's somebody across the room. Wow. And what he had back then was vertical. You know, you can, again, with the headphones, you know, you say, you know, fireworks or whatever, and it's totally above your head. And he had it. Wow. So I think, you know, technology's kind of almost still catching up to what he has, because he's, so anyway, we were, became friends. So I used some of that technology in one of my, couple of my tracks. But that, it's fascinated me for sure. But, and I know that 3D audio has tried to gain some kind of market into, you know, games. And I mean, it seemed to have a hard time getting a footing in the music industry, because people weren't sure if they wanted to hear a saxophone swirling around your head. And, you know, it's, you know, so people weren't sure, but, you know, but now, you know, there's different things coming out that has that aspect where you can place your instruments, like an orchestra or whatever, you can place it in different parts of the room or whatever. It still has a way to go to really get it accurate. There's aspects of visual you can kind of get away with 3D a little bit easier, but you can, I mean, without wearing the headset, you know. And I saw some really interesting performances at MuTech that really had that.
I didn't get a chance to go.
Yeah. I mean, there were some that were pretty impressive. And if you can get the 3D audio involved with that, you're a little bit closer. But there still needs to be a lot of understanding, like how it works. Again, I mean, my future goal is, it's an area that, you would have to get someone like myself who's been studying 20 years and about, you know, knowing how to project, absorb and project frequencies and understanding the frequency aspect of the human side, to be able to take those snapshots. I mean, whoever is out there who, you know, knows more about it, just contact me, because, you know, I want to explore that more and be the beta tester, you know. But there's, I mean, we're just still at the phase of putting headsets on. I mean, this is the 90s. That happened in the 90s, really. And then now we're just only beginning to see it commonly in terms of VR and stuff. And I know people want to start getting eventually out of the headset thing, the augmented thing. I don't know. So, you know, there's still a ways to go. It's definitely still a ways to go.
Definitely. Yeah. Do you think that the 3D audio has a chance for development in the gaming industry, seeing as that's probably the most commonly developing industry?
Yeah, it's already there. I mean, that's where 3D audio got its market, because
makes sense.
They targeted the games first, because that's where you put those headsets on or whatever. That's where they 3D audio was able to survive, was through games and maybe in the theater. I mean, that's a 7.1 or whatever. Yeah, that's different. But in terms of the binaural aspect, it's already in the games, you know. It's in different places, but in terms of music, I think it's kind of still be kind of in the development in terms of that. But I think I just read about someone who just did a binaural synth, like a hybrid synth with a binaural. And I think binaural has a potential as well, to hybrid into all the different types of instruments. And yeah, that's another way.
Well, elaborate a little bit more on binaural. I'm not familiar with it exactly. So you're talking about like a binaural synthesizer or something?
That's what I guess it gives you some more headroom, I guess, like some more dimension, you know, to the sound or something. That's what I think it is. And there's probably better explanations, you know, coming from people who are like a lot more techie. But my understanding is that, you know, it just gives us more dimension, you know, more accurate, being able to, instead of a flat, you know, left, right, you've got more dimension. That's what I kind of think it's ultimately, you know, the perception is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a field I'm really not familiar with.
But, yeah,
it's definitely a fascinating part of our technology that's developing around us.
Yeah, there's a lot of new things that, you know, it just takes time for people to discover, and hope it takes off more. Even that sensomorph thing, I think whenever people see it, it's like people just like, are immediately attracted to it and everything. But, you know, it takes time, like everything else, anything new anyway. What other fascinating thing, like any kind of gear that was interesting to you, what you saw there
Synthplex? You know, I was really...
A lot of modular stuff there.
A lot of modular stuff there, yeah. On the trades floor, there's, all kinds of modular companies out there. Even Moog had a set up, and who else was there? It was
can't remember. There was a lot of people there.
There's a lot going on there. One of the things I really enjoyed actually was Perfect Circuit Audio, the company, out in Burbank. They put a setup out, and they had a variety of stuff out there. They had a Surge setup, and they even they had this table setup, which you may have seen, where it was basically. Inside this cabinet, they had a modular system that's set up to do visual projection. So what they had set up was a box where it had magnetic strips, and on one side it controlled horizontal, and on the other side it controlled vertical. So you could play around with that, and it would have the Perfect Circuit Audio, design up there, and every time you would touch it, it would scramble in different colors and fun stuff like that.
Oh yeah, I think there were a lot of colors. Yeah, there were a lot of like things happening, and I think I kind of saw that. I didn't explore it or anything. Was it working? Didn't get time to get into that.
There was some there's so many companies over there that a lot of them I knew, but there was quite a few I didn't know. That were doing all kinds of different things, and some of them were all doing all digital modules, which was fun because a lot of them were experimenting with different ideas of how to play around with digital modules and coming up with different concepts with them that I hadn't even thought of myself.
Oh sure,
so
oh
no, there's so much experimentation going on. Right.
Oh yeah, there's sky's the limit now.
And I really enjoyed this. There's a vintage synth museum little setup. I don't know if you saw it. There was a. In like this, like kind of the middle building between the two main buildings.
I didn't get to that.
Okay, there was a vintage synth museum set up by a couple of rental houses and a couple of guys set up. So there was all kinds of great stuff. They had a Mellotron in there. They didn't really have any Oberheims in there, but they did have a lot of a couple of Rolands in there. They had what was my favorite? They did have a Moog modular setup that was a wall of panels, which was fantastic.
Right.
And this one guy who knew how to work it would do demonstrations on it.
Okay.
And that was just always fascinating to hear those beautiful tubes out there.
Have you been to the Vintage?
I know of it. I've not been there. Yes. It's out in East Bay, right?
Right, right. And I guess the owner, he was at the panel as well that I was in, and he moderated, actually.
Okay.
I wanted to, you know, I think you can rent that place too.
You can, yeah. Yeah. I've always wanted to go out there. I just haven't taken the time to go check it out.
Yeah,
Have you been to it yet?
I haven't. I have to, you know, they do these sound baths and stuff I want to check out.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so, it's again, it comes back to this transmission aspect, because, you know, these sound baths or whatever things that people kind of need to in their system to, you know, it's an energy thing too, you know, where you're encompassed with sound or frequencies or whatever. And so I just kind of thought that sounds a little similar to like this, the transmission process where, you know, you're cleansing or whatever, or just enjoying the sound or whatever.
I think a lot of musicians who are into synthesizers, I think a lot of us are very much into the idea of this, of music being therapeutic in a form.
Mm.
And to me personally, it's been very much that, you know, over the, I took a hiatus from music for about 10 years. And then in late 2016, I got back into it and I realized, why was I not playing? Because once I got back into it, it was just like a wonderful thing for me to just come into my little studio space and just play with my synthesizers by myself for hours on end.
Yeah, I mean, everybody goes through something where you have to, you know, just, you know, take hiatus or whatever. And I sort of took one. I had a son 7 years ago, and the only thing it's interesting because I got involved with another sort of this another Buddhist group or whatever collective, you know, and they did electronic music, and then they actually bought a lot of my gear, some of my gear, to master all their stuff.
Wow.
So then I thought, well, you know, and then they stopped kind of putting things out for a while. I'm like, well, I have all this stuff. So then that's kind of how I started thinking about remastering, you know, or archiving all my stuff, because I was waiting around for other people's stuff and that I had all mine. So that's kind of how I started, just might as well put it to use, and ended up, you know, with the 100 album thing. But that was my when I had my son, I was like, you know, that was the hiatus a little bit for me. And it was really interesting coming out of that, going head straight into like performing, because, again, like I had to deprogram myself from what I knew before, because what I knew before with Pro Tools, I could not do it live at all. I mean, there's no, and everyone's been telling me about live Ableton. And I thought, I have to do this. And it was, I'm glad, you know, I just finally dived in. I just know that Pro Tools, you just cannot, I mean, I don't know, I haven't upgraded too much recently, but I mean, it sounds great, but it just can't do any of the things almost that a lot of other programs can do anyway, from what I was been doing with lately, you know, plugging, having to trigger drum machines with the sequence with and have the stencil morph change sounds per song with different samples, and you know, have it instantly do it. And there's, I mean, there were so many little things that in time stretching stuff from, you know, maybe I have like a rhythm track from the 80s that it had its own time. You had to lock it in. And then kind of retuning stuff. And I mean, I don't know. There's so much to do, you know, with Ableton stuff. But anyway, jumping back into like the hiatus thing. It's interesting when, you know, I actually had my recorder when I gave birth. I had it on the table because I knew I wanted to record that first cry. And that was amazing because, you know, I don't know. I've been recording everything, might as well. So, I got it. Wow. And it's pretty amazing. And some years later, though, he, you know, he was actually diagnosed with autism. But what's interesting is that he's one of those rare 10% where he's also a savant. I don't know if you know that word.
Yes.
Some people don't know that word, but it's just where you, I don't know, child or adult or whatever, but they, it's kind of the Rain Man syndrome where they know how to do stuff that there's no way anyone can not no way, but like most people can't do. And you know, by the eight, I think right now he's seven and he's memorized, right now up to about 300 pi numbers.
Wow.
But he's going to be 400 next year. So it's going to keep going. But, and then he could tell you the day of the week of your birthday. Like if you told him your birthday, he'll just tell you what day it is. And then he's memorized like, wow, you know, the million, billion, centillion, whatever, all the way up to 900 million and the names of them. And it's just a memory thing. He like really into this memory thing. So that's kind of how I started getting, it was necessitated for me to understand neuroscience. And a neuroscience scientist studied him, I guess when he was six in San Diego. It's like the Center for Brain Cognition Center or something in San Diego. Anyway, this guy, Dr. Ramachandran, he was the, I guess, Time Magazine's most influential people, whatever, in 2011. But anyway, he studied my son. He was doing a savant study. And so I got sort of tapped into that realm about neuroscience. So, and then I started, and then I discovered the brain mapping. That's sort of how that came, how the idea of that. And then I discovered the sensor technology. I'm like, sensor this. And then brain mapping, and I put it all together, just like I put, you know, daisy chain science, and then get coming out with a new idea. So a lot of times, like stuff that you don't plan to invent or whatever, they come out of, you know, necessity sometimes, and because of, you know, the search for, it's not, you can't cure, you know, certain kinds of conditions, but in a search, you know, for answers or whatever, you just start dreaming up what if you can do this. Well, you know, it just starts with that, like you know, when you want something, to you really want something, you're gonna make it happen. So anyway, so then kind of propelled, you know, my brain development, I guess, to realize that, you know, if I start thinking of all these things that are happening to me now, and as I said, that, you know, these cast of characters come up when they're supposed to. So I've got my son who's a savant. I've got this phase of musical technology that's just changing and developing so fast, and I've got, you know, all these other aspects of my music, and you know, something is morphing into something. And so and I think it's kind of like a time where people are a lot more open to whatever you want to invent. So you know, I think I you know, I have to be really aware of what's happening now versus before. I think I was kind of I fell into the times and I evolved with it. But I think now I have to put more of a conscious thing. Especially I'm interested in AI, and, you know, I want to understand how to, you know, if there's a way to build an app for, you know, the stuff that my son needs or whatever. Ultimately, you know, with kids or people with autism, they just, it's hard for them to make friends.
Yeah.
So I want to, you know, right now he's taking a coding class, and I think they're using Python. And I'm already saying, well, I ultimately would want him to develop his own program where, you know, I guess, I don't know if you have to input, you know, random things that, you know, the computer would say back to him or whatever, but ultimately, you know, if you can create a program where it can be like your friend, you know, your computer friend, you know, if you can't really make friends because you're medically not able to, you know, that, you know, because, you know, autistic people, they love computers. I mean, you know, they say that a part of the Silicon Valley, you know, are people on the spectrum.
I wouldn't be surprised. One of my best friends from high school, he's currently working on his doctorate at UC Berkeley in botany, and he's considered a high functioning autist.
Oh wow!
And he's got Asperger's.
Oh wow! Yeah.
And you know, it's really fascinating for me because you know we've known each other for so long now, and I just had lunch with him last week. And, you know, he's doing great, and he actually just got a GSA award for doing a biology class. Amazing. Last semester, from, wow. Which was fascinating. It was fantastic for him.
Right.
And it's great to see him from when I knew him in high school to today, of how he's developed and how he's able to function so well. And even he told me that, you know, just the other day that, he said that it's rare for him to, you know, we went out and had lunch downtown Berkeley off of Ashby or Shattuck or something like that, around there. And he was telling me it's rare for him to come out. He's like, you know, he's saying I'm at school, and then he's now living in a communal home for grad students UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
But you know, and he's still doing great. You know, it's fascinating because he took I think back in maybe junior college, he took an acting class, and the professor actually pointed out to the rest of the class, he said, this guy here, he's autistic, and he doesn't understand emotions like we all do. So for him to be able to interact with us, he's acting all the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And like it was such an interesting perspective to me to think that my good friend is
he's acting
all the time to understand emotions, because he doesn't understand emotions like as the majority do.
Well, there's also it's a spectrum, so it's kind of this, I don't want to say stereotype, that you know they don't understand. Well, it's more of the social cues.
I think so too.
Because my son's very emotional. He really knows, like, if I'm upset or I'm happy about something or whatever. And he's very emotional. And again, he's high functioning. So, but there's definitely people who are like kids or whatever, just looking at spinning wheels on a truck. I mean, there's different levels, but, I think if they're functioning enough to be in college, I mean, that's, I mean, it's all great. I mean, it's a lot different levels, but, I mean, what do you find is it easy to have a conversation, or is it just talking about his thing all the time, his own interest?
He's mostly talking about the things he likes, but you know, he and I like to talk about Godzilla movies, so it's pretty good.
Okay, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but yeah. He took me and my girlfriend over to UC Berkeley last year, and he showed us the archives of all the botany. Archives down there, which is fascinating because he was showing us samples of plants from over 100 years ago.
Oh, wow.
It's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When they get into one thing, they know everything about it. Right recently, like every year, there's some kind of new explosion that happens. I think the first, when my son was five, Conrad, he could tell you the age differences of people. So, meaning like at his birthday, if he was a certain age and then his dad or something was a different, like, a, you know, if his dad was 5,000 something years old, how old would he be? And he would just tell you and it'd be right. And he never had exposure to math to be able to do that. That's the weird thing. There was no exposure at age five. I mean, I concentrated on communication because I thought, you know, with autism. He was diagnosed at 3, so I thought I was all pour everything into the social stuff. But I didn't know he had this math side. I didn't know he had this. Well, he's not really a great problem solver, but he's it's all memorization stuff. But I don't know how he does it. And then there's this other guy that was that I started to study. This name is Daniel Tammet, and he was he's the one of the most known savants, and he can describe what it's like, and he says that he visually sees the numbers. And he's memorized over...
I've heard that.
Yeah. So I think at some point he's memorized over like over 20,000 pi numbers in a week or something like that.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and he can tell you like something really fast. And there's no explanation how you could do it. He just sees it. He sees every number like a shape. Or it will remind them of something. So I mean, I would ask my son, like, how does he do it? Or what do you see? Or do you see this or that? But he just says he just knows it. But I don't know if he might be too young to explain. But eventually, I just kind of curious. It could also just be physiology, you know, where there might be just another aspect of the brain that's added on. Just like art, you know, art. You already know how to paint. You don't have to be trained or anything.
Yeah.
You just kind of know. And then, you know, same with music. You just have this intuition. And I think that sometimes I think people who can do art or music or have some kind of other thing other than your normal, I don't know how to explain it. You have your whatever talents. You know, I think it's almost like a different, an added organ. You know, like you just have an extra thing. And I know through when I was at San Diego talking to Dr. Ramachandran, and he was saying that, and I think one of the scientists walked in the room, and I forgot his name, but he walked out. But he said that that was the guy who was able to determine what area of the brain had math. Like there's different areas that you can pinpoint where things happen, and there is an area for math or something.
Yeah.
So I figure there must be, you know, for other things. So, but I think it is something that's like an extra thing that you are born with, just like the ability to be savant. I mean, you can't help but be born, you know, autistic or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or he could just be an advanced new kind of breed of human beings, because right now, what is it like, one out of 68 or something or more or less or whatever, you know, of people diagnosed now. Wow. So I think it's a shift in human evolution, and it's also perhaps the human species has to advance somehow, or it's always been evolving. We're evolving, but obviously we're extending our evolvement through technology and different things, but we ourselves are probably due to evolve, you know, our especially with all this you know, heightened technologically, you know, advanced capability that we have, we need to adjust. And so maybe, you know, there's new kinds of human beings that are born, but it hasn't perfected. In fact, there's a disability aspect where they can't do something, but they're advanced in other stuff, like we're morphing, you know, but it's like, you know, God or hasn't perfected the experiment.
Or maybe it is the evolution of humanity, but the majority of our culture doesn't understand that yet.
True. Too. Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. Yeah. I mean, we've evolved, but it doesn't exactly, because, or it's, you know, with autistics, you know, they're, you know, we say they're compromised, but maybe they're actually advanced, and we're just not, like you were saying, mm-hmm. we don't recognize it. It's very true. I mean, it's very true that I'm a big advocate of savants because it's an unrecognized area that it's often found in autistics, you know, and I don't see any kind of program out there that is supporting it at all. But everyone I talk to that has known or has a son or daughter who is autistic, they're like, oh, yeah, my son, you know, can memorize, you know, all these different things and know every single thing about whatever botany or whatever. They're really heightened in their abilities. The latest one this year, my son, he's mapping. He likes to,
cartography.
He studies, he discovered on MapQuest or Google Maps, the Google Map thing. And so he spent days and days and days on that. And like, he likes to memorize where every exit and, you know, where, and especially around the area, he showed me all the shortcuts to different things that I didn't know how to get there. And then he'll sound off with the same voice, like, in 500 feet, turn right, you start doing that. Hey, though, that same voice too is kind of funny.
That's pretty adorable.
I know. So he would draw these maps of the area and then I looked, I Googled online, you know, the definition of savants, and sure enough, it says mapping on as one of them. So I think he's classic. He's got the classic stuff, and I don't know what's going to happen next year. I do know that. I mean, every morning before he goes to school, I try to continue expand it, because how I see it is that, you know, this is kind of sound weird, I don't want the school to ruin him. I mean, because, you know, it's just, he's in public school. So, you know, there's
only so much they can do.
There's only so much they can do. And,
so are you like testing him at home or something like that?
I'm, there's a couple things every morning we work on. It's the pie to make sure, you know. And he likes to do it anyway. That's just what they always need routines, you know? So it's like, that's something to do before, you know, and also like the best time to do anything for the brain is the morning, because, you know, that's just for some reason that you're more able to absorb stuff, you know, just like when you're the best time to develop the brain is when people are like in, you know, 10 and under or whatever, either adolescents and younger, meaning like from 1 to 10, you know, that they're the most, they're developing, and their brains are the best for absorbing, you know, information and stuff. So, but to keep it alive and to keep alert, you know, is to throw something really hard to do in the morning. So I would keep expanding that. And so mainly it's that, and then I test to make sure he still can get people's. If you know, we have a calendar out, and I just ask him, July 20, and he would say Wednesday or Thursday, like, you know, and then I would write down every single thing he says, so I have a record of, you know. I could chart it if he wants, like how many times he was right. You know, I do this whole analysis thing. So it's just kind of fun for me. Yeah. And it's interesting, when I was in San Diego, they asked me if I wanted to meet another person like him. And so I met another savant child, and he was 8 years old. And they were studying him for telepathy, and he was studying physics in college.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but I think he was this guy named Ramses, but he's they're all really special and remarkable, but and to be tested for that and have it correct is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Because then, you know, there's a way more than we even think that we're capable, and that's why it's not I don't know, I'm just at a different trajectory perhaps, and so I'm always at this phase of doing everything in a vacuum again. It's just like this thing that I'm always going to have, and I'm always going to do things that are not like, you know, in at the times. I think it's just going to always be. But I think this is a great stage right now anyway. But I have to be, and I'm a lot more conscious of it now, which is good.
I was curious about how's motherhood come into play into your music and your art?
That's a great question. I've always written diaries about everything that I've done, and you know, everything as an artist and everything. But when my son Conrad was born, then everything started becoming about him. So everything's like all the notes and things. So everything that has been written the last 7 years is almost all about him. But I already knew that, first of all, I mean, the whole aspect of this is common, I was really fascinated and still am in awe about how to create a human being from scratch. I mean, as an artist or whatever, but then having to create human life from nothing. And I was always wondering I know how it works, but like, you know, from a whole, the cellular thing to like, and then shaping into like a human being, like you created a human being. Is like the weirdest thing for me. Like it's still like every time I look at my son, I think that's just amazing. That's a whole nother being that, you know, I don't know. I still am endlessly fascinated by what life can do on its own, you know? And, I eventually wanted to create an album, about that, you know, and, you know, and include my recordings. It's a really fascinating thing. So, how it affects my music though, you know, it's kind of, again, it'll probably be another thing that displays, how things develop, you know, and just, you know, a song, you know, perhaps about the womb and actually I was writing music knowing this while I was pregnant and so I want to write music that while I was in that state, you know, I was interested in like these states of mind or whatever. And so I wanted to create like the different phases. So one of them I've already done. And then there's a whole aspect of the savant too. I mean, there's a whole aspect of like, memory comes into play as well. And actually it's funny enough, and this may be part of his strange, I don't want to call it strange, but you know, uniqueness. I mean, right now he insists that he was born in 1981 and he describes all of it, all the different things as, you know, who he married and he describes all this stuff. And there's been people, who've kind of said, well, you know, he's actually like talking about his past life,
like a reincarnation.
And then where's this come from? Because the fact is, he was never exposed to math when he was doing that. So where did that come from? So there's all this weird layers of like, is that, I mean, and it's so detailed that you start to believe it. I mean, even though like an outside person might think, you know, like it's kind of some jargon, you know, from just he's imagining stuff or whatever. But, cause he would say stuff like, you know, and that was before I met you. You know, that was 1994 and that was before I met you. I know.
It's interesting because I've had two friends who told me after they hit the age of 40, they both had an experience like that where they had a dream that was so realistic that they literally believe that it was memories from a past life. And they 100% believe it, and you know I have no reason to doubt it. So that could be something with your son. It's so fascinating. I'm not sure.
My personal take is that for myself is that, you know, I never got into the whole past life thing because I just don't know. There's even a question, you know, is there a God? I mean, there's all kinds of questions, but I mean, nobody knows, but then, you know, things kind of test me, I guess, and that's one of them, you know, whether, you know, do I correct it or, you know, should I, because if it's true, I don't want to say anything, but if it's not true, I just don't want to suppress, like, maybe that's his creativity. No one knows, but he's so detailed about it, and he's always talking about it. That's one of his main things he talks about, so I don't know what that,
and what he that is. And he recalls, like, the same memories?
Yeah, it's always the same. Yeah, it's always the same. And he would talk about different cities he's been to, and I wonder if, did he find it online, and did he go, you know, all that stuff. But anyway, I did take him to a past life specialist because I just had to, I knew, you know, people, you know, from my meditation, you know, classes, you know, I know, you know, people, but, so I, you know, into that realm. Anyway, so I brought him over and I brought Conrad over there and I videotaped it and everything. And, you know, he really went off and, talked about all the past life stuff. And, anyway, you know, the specialist said that, you know, that she thinks he's just a natural medium, and, you know, of course, coming from her, she's, you know, she may, you know, from her perspective or whatever, but, you know, they kind of think that he doesn't know he died.
Interesting perspective.
He doesn't know he died. So he's always talking about, or, you know, maybe it led up to a certain point, was 35 or something, and it stopped and he didn't know when that's, but he's still talking about those memories. So I don't know. But then, you know, other people might, you know, and I don't know if it's really 1981, but, you know, because where does this, the memory math thing, maybe his memory is so strong, he remembers all the way to the past life thing, because his memory is what his special skills are. I mean, yeah. It's so profound that maybe it's so deep, because he remembers, I swear, when he was 6 months years old, he dropped a Cheerios on the stairway, and he told me about that later, about the Cheerios, and we were at the stairwell at some point. He's like, that's where the Cheerios, like he knew, he remembers.
At 6 months. Yeah. He remembers that.
Oh yeah.
That's fascinating.
He remembers stuff that when he was like a baby, that there's no way, you know? So that's why I think that it's so acute, that his memory is so acute that it probably there's a channel there that's tapping into something, and I don't want to stop it, because if it's true, I don't want to suppress. I don't want to stifle whatever it is. Yeah. But then he's going to tell people that he's 35 years old. He's seven. Wow. So I know, I don't know what to do.
Must be an old soul.
I know. I don't know I'm back and forth about it. I don't know what to do about it, but. Again, you know, if I stifle that, does the other stuff stifle? So I don't want to touch it. But what I can do is, you know, give him all the best possible supports and whatever. I mean, from like swimming classes, coding mm-hmm. school, piano lessons, and he actually can write notation. I mean, he's been writing notation for a year now. Right. He's got that's another thing we do in the mornings. That he just write some notation. So you know, he's multifaceted, and just to get some form and structure, you know, and then when it's unstructured times, that's when all the other stuff comes out, and he'll go on and on and on, like run on for pages and pages about different, you know, his you know, exact the times and dates, speaking of times and dates, of certain events that happened in you know, even earlier than 1981. So
that's an interesting correlation. I just pieced together from how you were always, you know, from a young age, you were, you know, writing in diaries, and even your all your music was dated.
Yeah, I know the date and time.
Yeah,
and he's that. He has that too.
Wow.
He, and naturally, I didn't teach him to do date and times, but he, yeah, his memory is so profound, that he'll remember stuff that the days of a date or something, like say, like he loves like the Tilden Park steam trains. I mean, that's his big gigantic thing. That's a kind of a secret a lot of people don't know about. There's these steam trains in the Berkeley Hills. And I videotaped literally like just every week. I at some point I had to bring him because he had to go to those. So I would videotape every single week, and he knows every single date and exactly what, you know, what happened in all those times, like for like a couple of years. And if he's missing just one of them, December 20, 2012, it's missing. It's when he, it's the same route. It's the same route. And he's like, I'm missing it. And he would go crazy because he's missing the one video of the one, you know, ride. And, but, anyway, so there was, you know, there would be times where, maybe somebody said something to him that day or whatever, and he would remember what day that was, that stranger said something, you know. So it's pretty profound. I mean, like, you know, if I ever forget anything, I can rely on him to remember something. Or if I get lost, he'll know
the direction.
He'll
probably know the shortcuts.
I know. And then, you know, I'm going to Asia this summer, so I'm gonna have him memorize, you know, the maps.
Nice.
So you know, it comes in kind of useful or whatever. But then there's the other side, you know. It has to be, you know, a certain way, and it's, you know, that's just the nature of that condition, that it's very kind of gets very rigid too, and it has to be a certain thing, and it's very classic. So, you know, I've obviously been really absorbed in that in the last 7 years or so, and I'm actually raising him myself. So, you know, that's my style. I guess that's okay. How I do it.
All right. And you're still able to, you know, produce music and do shows.
I haven't slept a whole, you know, 8 hours for 7 years. I mean, it's been, you know, it's been very choppy and a lot of coffee in between. So I try to
bring you a cup too if you need some, by the way.
Thank you. Probably, so it's been very, you know, I've always been self, you know, driven, or, you know, if I don't know the words can't do, you know, so it's just like, you have to do it. So, it's a half and half kind of moments now where, you know, say he's in school now and I get the time to do certain thing, you know, it's kind of one of those things. I'm sure a lot of people have that too, because they have to work, you know, all full things, and, you know, and they have to come back. And so, you know, whenever kids come into play, everything gets chopped in half. And I remember somebody telling me a long time ago that, you know, if you ever have kids, say goodbye to your art. I always remember that. And because of that, it's never, they just become integrated, because, you know, I won't let that win me, you know, somebody's little statement there. But so one way or another, it gets out. It's something is done. So, you know, if I've disappeared for 7 years, I come back with 100 albums, mm-hmm. you know. And part of that too, like, I felt a little intimidated by the state of the industry, you know, that no matter what you do, you won't get noticed. I mean, no matter what. I mean, even 100 albums probably still don't even get, you know, get noted. So I just kind of, I don't know, maybe it's that another, that's something I never grew out of, you know, the perspective, like, you know, nobody's going to hear this. So, and so then maybe I don't care. So, so then I get stuff done. And then if, and you know, there's, it's really great when, you know, people, I've had really great feedback, you know, especially after a show and, you know, and stuff, and, or people contact me and they really like my work or whatever. I mean, I do really appreciate it more than they think, because, you know, the, 'cause of so many years that I've, put into this or whatever, it's not for, you know, for a hit or whatever. I try, that was a phase at one point too, you know, try to do a hit or something. And that's what Transfiguration kind of was. There's certain songs in there that sound like, that have a structure. And, you know, one thing I did learn from Nile Rodgers, you know, when he listened to my demo, I went over his apartment in New York, and he was very gracious to be, to, you know, do that, you know, and, you know, he gave me sort of like the secrets of the hit, you know, like what makes a hit, you know, but, and so he, you know, he basically focuses everything on the vocals. And so that Transfiguration was, you know, my Serenai album Transfiguration was, kind of, taking that information, and it's probably the one few albums that my vocals is pretty upfront. You know, it's probably the only, almost the only one. I should get, probably get more into that again, in terms of utilizing my vocals. And just to go back again, I forgot to describe, you know, or it to inform, you know, what Serenai was, you know.
Yes, I'm very curious.
Yeah, because that was kind of, I jumped out of that and just other things. But so basically Serenai, C-Y-R-N-A-I, is kind of like editing my name, Carolyn. So it's using some of the letters in my name. Of course, I added the I or whatever. And it was during art school. And I was just playing around with the letters and stuff. But it actually gave me this platform, you know, just like a stage name or whatever. And where it just like everything else, like, you know, it doesn't belong to me. Like, it, I mean, it does belong, it's mine, but it's a separate thing from, it's kind of my diary, you know, like you just tell it everything. It's always there for you. And, you know, you can give it all your problems, or you can, you know, give it all your solutions or whatever. And it's a name that, like, you can, it was kind of symbolized the subconscious, you know, the art side. I mean, it was the subconscious, whereas Carolyn Falk is the conscious and the, more, it's a different, like, you know, family personality maybe. And then, and the Serenai was just like purely like, it's more raw form. I mean, it could be all the subconscious, the dreams, and experiments and, the, you know, the hard edge stuff, or, you know, it's just like this, other side that, like, you know, I actually come from a really conservative family, so maybe it kind of is a way to hide, you know, all the stuff I have, you know, all the dark side, or the all the questions about questions and philosophies about life, you know, there's just so many, you know, aspects of the Carolyn Falk life that I couldn't really use. Because I partially, as I said, I just have this, you know, bankers and investment managers and, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, so I do have that, you know, that kind of weird split, and then it's very different, like a very different split. And, And I, at some point, I actually put, I actually was going to close the whole Serenai thing. I mean, some years ago, I was just, I went, that part of my meditation practices was, you know, to probably to purify all that, the dark stuff that I had. I mean, I was, had depression in my 20s, and I had like fighting that stuff for years, actually. And I had these nightmare dreams, and it was really overwhelming stuff. And that's partially why I was in this vacuum too, because, it was, you keep stuff to yourself, and that's where Sarah and I had all that, you know, it was this, it's a whole realm, you know, that, Sarah and I belonged, everything belonged to it. And I would write all my really strange writings, and you know whatever, like my demons and my battles and everything, would go into my diaries, which I haven't published yet. And you probably read stuff about, you know, the relationship stuff and or whatever, all the struggles that really went into Sarah and I. So at a certain point, I think it was like 2003 or something, I started kind of going into the studies, the meditation practices and stuff, and purified all the negativities and just really the heavy stuff. So, but then Sarah and I came back. Like, everybody wanted that. So what do I do? So, you know, it's funny because I've evolved the purifications enough to the point where it doesn't matter anymore. That's where, you know, it doesn't affect you because you don't care about it. Mm-hmm. It only affects you if it gets you, if it gets under your skin. That's when it still matters. You know, it's like if you had a, you know, you didn't like someone or whatever, and they're always on your mind, it's bugging you all the time. You know, you know, it's over when you don't care. You know, that like, it's interesting now. It's not like something that's like a thorn or anything. So that's one of the indications that I could probably return Sarah and I without it affecting me in any way in terms of it being negative. In fact, I can now evolve it, Sarah and I, into hybrid it, that emergence with more advanced stuff that I've learned in the Carolyn Falk realm, you know, in the, I know how to manage it. It's like energy management. I know how to, you know, get whatever demons to back off or whatever. You know, I it's not even there anymore. Like, I don't get depressed anymore at all. Like, I got rid of it. Some years ago, like I don't wake up with it. And so, now I can really focus on, you know, the contributing, you know, to society in a much more productive, you know, and healthy manner, but at the same time, still bring to make the dark side still meaningful because people still need it. I mean, they still need to evolve through it. But still have it, but make it kind of cool. Like you can dark can still be kind of cool, but it's just not something that's gonna drag you down. I mean, it can be depressing still, but it's not gonna kill me. You know, it's not gonna hurt me anymore. But it's also an example of what you can do to get through stuff. Like you can create through, maybe Sarah and I is kind of coming back to give an example of what it's like to kind of like be okay with like expressing it, through an art or whatever. It just at the time, I probably didn't have it tamed, but it, you know, I was in some ways people have called it, unencumbered. Like it's just something refreshing about it that it's not encumbered by anything because it's free to express. And I think that's probably why, like, it's, it, you know, people find it intriguing again, but again, you know, people are kind of studying stuff back in the '80s anyway. I mean, like '80s have come back and I guess I got swept up in that, but, And there's a lot of people doing something similar now, like the sound or the kind of experimenting I was doing, I'm hearing, like currently. So in a way, it was my projection back then. And one of my funny little quirky statements at my MuTech panel was that eventually, if there was no time limit, and if somebody eventually invented that sensor technology, some way to tap into the frequencies that you had prior, whatever, you know, and that the ability to recall, you know, the digital recall, you know, was my stuff recalled from the 80s? Because, yeah, because was that a recall from the somebody way in the future that signaled it somehow? But I don't know. That's just, it was a past life. I mean, the going into the past life thing again. But so it's interesting about time because, you know, why it's such a mass, you know, thing right now to need to retrace and recall things. But at the same time, we're technologically capable, you know, of... I think there's something really brand new that's going to happen. I hope, you know, that's, you know, that, you know, solves some of the issues and why, you know, why we have to go back and solve some issue, you know, in terms of like, maybe we should have had digital technology hybriding with modular. Now we'll do it now. And then move forward. You know, maybe there's as I'm speaking, I'm looking at your turntable.
Let's see. That's a very pretty record in there,
yeah,
right
it's,
now.
It's a nice turntable you have.
Thanks.
But it's so funny. I just have this pseudo turntable right now. I don't play anything on it because I don't want to ruin the record. Just the needle,
right?
You know. But I understand you're doing some. You're putting together some modulars yourself?
Yeah. I put my first album out back in March, and you know, that was a feat because I basically spent like 2 years in my little studio here writing music and, you know, putting maybe like a minute snippet here and there on like Instagram. That's about it. Mm. And then I realized I've got like 3 albums sitting on a hard drive. What should I do with it? So I eventually, you know, took the time in December actually to decide what tracks I want to put together. I put together 6 tracks for an EP and finally got that mastered and got it produced on cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes.
But I did that because that seems to be the trend right now. You know, it's like I'm trying to see what's the best marketing scheme for, you know, for a small solo person like myself. And so I did the cassette tape thing, and I've maybe sold like 4 out of 100. And like all my other friends were like, "Yeah, I wouldn't do that," but I did, and you know, I don't regret it. I still enjoy the fact that I did it, you know. And I did all the artwork, you know, did the whole jacket design myself, and even used a piece of photography that a friend of mine took of me back in 2008 as the cover, which I still think is probably kind of a frightening thing to see if you don't know what it is. it's a personal thing. With the whole, you know, modular thing, that's something that, again, like I kind of told myself I want to do this because I've been playing synthesizers probably since 2000 is when I first really started to get into it, and right. You know, so I've got, you know, a small collection of vintage and modern, and then I started to get into modular because I found it so fascinating. I started looking at all these different companies making their own different modules and things like that, and how you could take different modules and piece them together to create something completely different and new that no one else is really, you know, that everybody is already doing, but you can basically curate your own synthesizer.
That's true. I mean, that's one thing special that you can... really, it's got your personality, your own, you know, set of, you know, your, however you want to, cord them together, you know, different, it's all, you, it's, you can customize your own personality however you want, you know.
And very much a lot of it, like, as you, before you understand how everything works, it's very much a science experiment of what is this going to sound like? Because at first, you know, you might not know, but once you get a bit more associated with the different companies out there and what different what different sounds you get from these different filters and oscillators put together, then you can really start to understand what you're putting together and what you're going to create and what will come out of it, maybe.
Have you, what's your DAW? What is your DAW? Pro Tools or?
I'm using, what is that thing?
To record
it's
into?
It's Logic.
Oh, okay, Logic, yeah. Okay.
I use Logic Pro right now.
Right.
And I've been using it since probably 2003.
Okay, yeah.
So I kind of fell in love with it just because I understood it right away, and it's pretty intuitive. I tried Cubase. I didn't jive with me, you know. But I haven't used Cubase since 2003, so it's not really, I didn't keep up with the technology. I've been meaning to check out Ableton Live because all my friends have told me it's really good.
I know like everybody's recommended it to me, especially for live, and I knew I was eventually going to, but it was so hard to jump, you know, the DAW, but it was like necessity, like I had to do it. But then once I started seeing what it could do, you can be versatile now. Like you can do one program for one thing and another program for another. But for years, I just stuck with the one that I'm the most familiar. Again, though, the only drawback I'm seeing now is just this. I don't know if I'm wrong, but it's the quality of sounds. I hear the big difference. I am hearing it, between Pro Tools and Ableton. Ableton can do way, way more, but the sound, maybe I have it on the wrong setting, but, that department may sway me back just 'cause I'm buggy. Like it might bug me a little bit because of the sound, but it's still, I don't know if I can see how I can work between those two. I have to figure out, because if Ableton's cut really customizable, I don't know if I can have it talk to Pro Tools. I haven't done it yet. So, yeah. But I don't know. I spent so many years like sound designing, you know, through the analog way, you know, in the 80s, and, you know, experiment so much that like I'm not as, I don't know, like I don't spend the time as much starting with like the first tone type of thing. I think because of my time constraints, I don't have the time, and I need to get to what I need pretty fast. So I, you know, either I customize and put into presets, and I just need to get to where I need to go pretty fast. I mean, but I know, you know, film composers, they have wall-to-wall modulars and they can do it. Yeah. So I think it's just a matter of like understanding it a little bit more, like how to get there. I'm sure there's like really good little pieces of gear I can put between stuff to get it to get where I want fast, you know. And then, I mean, considering the fact that, you know, you can do a lot out of just one piano. You can get a really emotional effect out of just a piano, you know, like a melody. You know, do you really need a room full, you know, wall-to-wall gear, and you don't create any emotional at all? Certain depends what you're after. I mean, there's really, I mean, sometimes I would see, you know, wall-to-wall, you know, gear, and it sounds like something I've heard in a club like the night before, and it's not as unique, you know. It's danceable, but it just depends on what you're after, I guess. So that's why, like, I want all the tools. Like, I want every choice, because like if I want just a piano and a reverb and it's got like a really emotional effect, you know, that's all it really needs. And I don't want to limit myself to like, oh, I'm just going to be this one. I only play this one Moog. That's what I'm known for. <You know? laughs> I, 'cause then, you know, then you're really locked into, you know, And I know performers like that. They're known for one thing, and that's fine, you know. Again, I think my whole thing is just the total awareness of how life evolves and how things change, and then like being able to access any of those emotions at any time, like gives me a lot more choice and layers and moods, and you can't put your finger on stuff. Like the most mysterious stuff is the most interesting. I mean, you know, when you hear, sometimes my work is so abstract, like, you know, like you can't put your finger on it. And it's kind of like the abstract painting, I guess. You can just read whatever you want into it. And then certain things are very spelled out, like a dance piece, you know, that's really danceable and very simple, mm-hmm. with a really great beat, you know. And then so I don't limit myself to any kind. I mean, you know, I don't play different kinds of music, but I play, you know, in the electronic music realm, you know, the varied styles, like sound, it could be soundtrack, dance, thematic or whatever. I mean, I don't play country music, for example. You know, sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah. I mean, I've always, probably because of my influences in the past, you know, my industrial influences. It just depends on what kind of music you like or whatever. I would love to get into film music a lot more. It's just like you have to make all those connections and you have to live in LA, maybe.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. you know, everyone I talk to, that's the situation. I mean, unless you get something up here and then go down there and everything and whatever. But and there's a lot of pressure involved with that too, and a lot of the approvals. And have you gotten into that at all? You know about
it? I have not. I just remember, Tom Hulkenberg's panel at Cineplex, and he talked about how he got into it.
Oh, right.
And how complicated it was of, like, you know, moving from, Netherlands out to LA to pursue that being, like, you know, a touring musician for many years, and now, you know, trying to be bass in LA and working for other studios and other musicians and working yourself up to eventually get those jobs. And now, you know, he's flourishing. You know, he's all over the place now, which is great. But, you know, it took him a long time to get to that point.
Yeah, you work under people and for a while, and that's fine. I mean, I try to get into, when I was, you know, had time to be in L.A. or whatever. But, it's so saturated, you know, with people wanting the exact same thing, that's whatever, true. You know. So I've been to some panels, you know, women in film and things like that. And I think like Sony had a Sound for Film Fest or conference. They've happened in the fall or several times. And Tom was another keynote for one of those. And he talked about all that. And there was a women's one this last year. And I think there's only 4% female film composers.
Not surprised.
you know, 4%. So, but anyway, everyone's always said I should. I mean, even the days I was trying to actually do pop, they said, "Well, it sounds like soundtrack." So no matter what, it's always been like more experiential, I guess. So I think my stuff is really primed, but it's just more like, again, like trying to find where that the plug in would be, you know, in that world. Because I know that maybe down the line, you know, I can, you know, send some things out. My whole thing is, like, in the past, I didn't even make too much effort, like, sending my stuff out to record labels or anything. Like, I just put things out myself. Which is interesting now because, you know, Dark Entries came out of the blue and wanted to release my work, and I had competitors, and, you know, like 3-4 people from different parts of the world, like, you know, Amsterdam, New York, San Francisco, you know, just England, you know, people wanting to release my 80s stuff, like all like in the same like few months. Wow. it was like even maybe in the same month, December last, you know, some.
No, it was like kind of like a bidding war to see who.
There was, I mean, there was a slight one, yeah, but, and which I kind of felt bad for the other labels because, you know, I would have wanted to put, I wanted that demand before, you know, so suddenly it was there and I couldn't, I had to say no. And it was like, I don't know, I felt bad, like, you know, and so, you know, one step at a time, I think Dark Entries, you know, since, you know, they invested a lot in this box set, you know, we just have to give it its respectful, you know, marketing time period. And then I'm sure I can, you know, try to do one step at a time. If another label comes up, then we'll see at that point. But right now I'm trying to explore the live a bit more because, and that's one area I have not whatsoever explored. I mean, same with video. It's like the kind of things that you should really be doing. You know, obviously, I've said before that, you know, I spent most of my focus on the recording studio, which is why I have 100 albums. And then if I spent that same kind of focus on live, I'd have 100 years of live, right?
Yeah.
So that's, there's some, a little bit of the making up for that. And I think because I haven't done live or video as much, and that's why, like, not too many people know about me. And it's just, it's almost the beginning, but not really. I mean, I'm kind of, grouped in with like the legacy of the 80s, I guess, but, and the 90s and, you know, the whole resurgence. So I'm, wanting to, yeah, I mean, I think it's time. And I think it's also unfair to audiences to have like so much stuff come out, like 100 albums in a box set, and then not let people see, you know, see me play or do anything live, because it's kind of it's kind of unfair to audiences to kind of do that, like, you know, when you have that level of release, it's good to meet people and meet your fans and show your face or whatever. Yeah. It's kind of more,
I think, more now than ever. Mm-hmm. The whole fan giving back to the fans has like has become a huge thing.
The fan?
Yeah. Well, like, you know, the artist and the fan interaction.
Oh yeah, and the whole social media, and, you know, that realm. Yeah. I think because of that, you know, I've stayed in computer land, you know, since that's the comfort zone. Then, you know, I've been interacting a lot more with Facebook, and, you know, that's been my regular. But I really wanting to travel more and bring it to Europe, and that's been way, way overdue for like decades. So hopefully, you know, cause every time I've played out, it very rarely, I mean, it's really great to meet like people who've known my work or the new people who haven't heard my work or whatever. And just the whole discovery, I think people are just blown away, you know, when they find out how much I have. And I'm really glad that it's happening now than like 10 years from now. Yeah. then I'll be, I don't know. So, and then the thing is I have to juggle that, you know, with, you know, my son, and I think it's all right. I mean, he's getting older now, and, you know, that's the tricky part of it, to be able to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Helen, I want to thank you so much for coming out and chatting with me for quite a while.
Yes,
this is really,
I know,
special. Thank you.
Thank you, and for providing that opportunity to, you know, talk for, you know, this time and meet you in my favorite city, you know, that I've worked, you know, that most of my materials come from, you know, San Francisco. And it kind of brings me back. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you again, Brad, for coming out.
Thank you. Thank you.